You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about a new effort to get hormonal birth control for men onto the market.
First, it's time for a weekly review of state news. This week, we'll look at a possible stumbling block for the Foxconn deal, a high-technology business plan for Green Bay, and news about the Packers' new starting quarterback and the state license plate slogan.
Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks.
Well, negotiations are going on with the ginormous company, Foxconn, to open this big plant in Racine County. Now, it's going on in WEDIC, the Economic Development Group. State Senator Tim Carpenter, a Democrat from Milwaukee, said there was a hiccup this week. Here he is talking to WTMJ-TV in Milwaukee.
They made a tremendous error that would force the deal to fall apart.
So, Rob, he says this, but he can't tell us what the error is because this is a closed session. What do we know about this, Rob, if anything?
Yeah, this is all, it's all a bit mysterious. So, so Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation was supposed to vote on Foxconn contracts. A lot of, not all of, but a portion of the state's giant aid package for this giant company is going through this economic development board. And they were due to vote, and they didn't. Instead, they went into closed session, and the only information that we really have comes from Carpenter, who characterized it has a nuclear bomb that, if it hadn't been addressed, would have basically made it hard for the state to recoup any of its money. And what's the question that I have, and I think probably everyone has who's read the reporting on this, is was this some sort of like a technical error, like a drafting error that can be corrected, or is this more something that gets at the substance of the deal and could sort of send this into a tailspin? And that's just, I think it's just not clear.
Right. The hope here, I think, from people who support or are worried about the Foxconn deal is that, okay, we're putting this money into it, but we want provisions. We, as the state of Wisconsin, we want provisions that if Foxconn doesn't live up to their end of the bargain, we get some of that money back. The concern here, and again, we don't know the specifics, the concern here was that there's something in this deal that right. would have made it so the state couldn't get money back in that event.
Right. And so, but the thing to understand is that it wasn't a case where Carpenter was just like in the minority. They voted and he disagreed with the substance of the deal, which you could imagine happening. They held this up. They did not vote on this. They're going to take time and redraft the language. The board member said there's a trade trip coming up to Israel with Governor Walker and WEDIC members, so they're pushing it back by at least probably at least about a month. So I see that as a piece of evidence on the side that this is more of a drafting error. But I guess it's good that it was caught, but it's just a little weird.
Now, another Foxconn story you've been tracking, the impact on Wisconsin's workforce. They'd have a lot of jobs if all goes according to plan, a lot of skilled jobs. And there's concern in northeastern Wisconsin and the Fox cities that they're having a hard time finding that kind of skilled worker as it is. Would this lure more people away from people who are already in place there?
Right. So obviously there's been a whole lot of reporting around Foxconn and its effects or what its possible effects would be in Wisconsin. And so we and USA Today Network Wisconsin had a pretty interesting story as a collaboration among several reporters in that, within that Fox Valley area, talking to both manufacturers and sort of economic development types. And there's, there would be some positive effects and some potentially negative effects. It's sort of interesting to think through. So there are suppliers. A project the size of Foxconn would create a supply chain, and so a manufacturer that makes components could potentially, they see this as an opportunity to get some business with Foxconn, perhaps. But it is also a thing that you hear a lot in Wisconsin, that it is hard for some employers to find workers to fill their current labor needs. And that is especially acute in more rural areas in the state. And so you could imagine that even if the project benefited the state's economy overall, that there could still be sort of regional winners and losers, and it could become, there would be this gravitational pull toward southeastern Wisconsin. And so it's at least a question, where does that leave northwestern Wisconsin or somewhere else?
And a potentially more positive outcome when people look at the skills gap in Wisconsin. It sounds like, reading an extension report, Wisconsin does a pretty good job of keeping skilled, often college or technical college educated workers in the state. We fare very poorly at luring those workers from other states. But maybe if there's this jobs boom fueled in part by Foxconn, maybe we'll have more people setting up shop here, moving across the border into Wisconsin.
Sure. I mean, yes, I think it's a genuinely an open question, and that the sort of optimistic read is reasonable. That is sort of the way it works. People go to where the jobs are in a lot of cases. And yeah, you could imagine we get a bunch of people moving into Wisconsin from Illinois or northern Indiana or Minnesota, which would be nice. So, yeah, I mean, it could go that way as well, for sure.
Talking to Rob Metzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. A related note, high-tech jobs in Wisconsin maybe. Microsoft and the Green Bay Packers are teaming up to create something called Titletown Tech. What's that?
Yes, this is a very interesting project. This is Microsoft Corporation has a project called TechSpark that is targeting six different cities in the United States, especially smaller cities and sort of non-Silicon Valley places, to start up these sort of like tech incubator programs and put money into, helping to train tech workers, to encourage and get resources to new startups. And create sort of mentorship programs for folks who want to get into that industry. And yes, they announced on Thursday that one of these six nationwide projects will happen in Green Bay. Both the Packers and Microsoft will contribute $5 million towards a center there, and there's a bunch of affiliated programs. So it's a pretty interesting big piece of economic news for northeastern Wisconsin.
Any idea when this will actually open up?
This was just the announcement. So there's a whole construction project. I don't know the exact timeline, I guess, in front of me, but I do think they'll take a couple years to lay the groundwork here, and it'll be interesting to see what the ultimate economic effects will be. That would take time because these really are aimed at incubating and new startups, which always take time to see sort of which ones take hold. But it's a promising, I think it's a good piece of news for sure.
Let's stay in Green Bay for a moment. A lot of talk about that. Of course, Aaron Rodgers' injury. He's recovering now from collarbone surgery. Best of luck to him on his recovery. Now his backup, Brett Hundley, is in the spotlight. His on-field performance I'll leave to the sports experts. But you had a feature on some off-field fun facts about Brett Hundley. What do we know about him?
Indeed, yes. Our Kendra Minard in Green Bay called some great stuff to get to know our new quarterback. Absolutely was one of our most popular stories this week. So we know he seems like a pretty cool guy. He's a pretty good chef and likes to post photos of his foods. He has a sister who has epilepsy, and he has become an ambassador for the Epilepsy Foundation's Athletes Versus Epilepsy program. And he has a rescue dog, a border collie mix named Dakota. So, there's lots. My favorite line was my colleague Tim Langton said, he is the best Brett ever to play quarterback for Green Bay, as far as I know.
And I looked at his Twitter feed and some of his food pictures. It looks like he's making some good and kind of complicated stuff. So maybe, do you think a future Food Friday guest here on Central Time?
I'm for it. Maybe a food columnist for USA Today Network.
That was one of your most popular stories. Here's one that might be one of your others, I bet. The head of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce got attention. He renewed his call that we should think about changing our license plate slogan, America's Dairyland, to something more modern and catchy and up-to-date. You got a lot of reaction there reporting on that, Rob.
Yes, and to give credit where due, I believe the Wisconsin State Journal broke that one. This business lobbyist, I think he sort of floated it out as a concept, but it is the sort of thing that really pushes people's buttons. I've actually written on this subject in the past, and it's something about how it gets to people's sense of Wisconsin, what it is, its heritage. Yeah, some people gave a hard pushback on changing from America's Dairyland.
Okay. We had a lot of callers, too, who pushed back. They want to keep America's Dairyland, and we heard from a few people saying go back to the yellow license plate. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, I like the yellow license plate. I'm for it. My loyalties are like fully established here. I have written about the 1985 contest under then Governor Tony Earl, where people could write in and suggest their proposed slogans, and the winner of that contest was "Eat Cheese or Die," and to me, you can't top that. In my heart, that is always Wisconsin's slogan.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joined us for a weekly look at Wisconsin news.
First, more than 400 couples around the world will soon be recruited for a new clinical trial, the drug that's set to be tested, a new contraceptive gel for men.
The quest to develop a male equivalent to the birth control pill has been a long and difficult process. Just last year, a clinical trial for a new form of hormone-based male birth control was shut down after participants reported serious side effects.
This time around, there's hope that things will be different, but just why has it been so difficult to create the male counterpart to the pill?
Dina Fine-Marin joins us now. She's a health and medicine editor at Scientific American, where she recently wrote a piece called "The New Push for the Male Pill." Dina, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, this new male pill isn't a pill. You reported on a hormonal gel that I guess one would rub on one's shoulders?
Exactly, yeah. So it's an interesting idea. This is a hormonal contraceptive with the same two hormones that the controversial injection had last year, but this would be rubbed onto a man's shoulders daily. And the idea is that could sidestep some of the side effects that we saw with the injection last year because it would be a more regular introduction of hormones. So the idea is you would have a more consistent hormonal level throughout your time as opposed to an injection every 8 weeks.
So somebody would be absorbing these hormones through their pores on their shoulder, I
exactly,
guess.
Exactly, yep. So it's going to include two hormones, progestin, which suppresses sperm creation in the body, and testosterone. And the testosterone is to keep you at healthy levels of testosterone in the body while your testosterone levels would still be too low to be producing sperm that could obviously get one's partner pregnant.
Now, we've had a birth control pill, a hormonal birth control pill for women for a long time, decades now. Why is it more difficult for men, or has that just not been a priority until the last 10 or 20 years?
That's a good question. I would say it's a little column A, a little column B. The scientific obstacle has been that while theoretically a similar hormonal birth control pill would inhibit sperm production in men, in practice it's really more complicated than that because the pill essentially tricks the body into acting as though it's already pregnant, making it temporarily infertile. But if you're trying to inhibit testosterone production in the testes, reducing sperm levels, it's a tough balancing act because if the sperm levels get, pardon me, if the testosterone level gets too low in the blood, that means you'll have some serious side effects. You won't be able to ejaculate. You may not have good muscle mass. You'll have altered libido. Obviously, these are things people want to avoid. So the challenge has been trying to, I guess, address that problem. But if you give an oral form of contraception, an oral form of testosterone, rather, it leaves the body too quickly, meaning the pill would be impractical because men would have to take it just too many times a day.
So there's this incredible juggling act, I guess,
right,
between a couple different hormones, their levels, and maintaining a consistent level over time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this this one injection that you mentioned earlier that seemed promising, I guess, at first.
Right.
What kind of effects, side effects were happening that led him to pull the plug on that one?
Yeah, so last year a study that was headed up by several folks, including the World Health Organization, looked really promising. It suppressed sperm production in men by about 96%. It was 96% effective, which sounds really great, but the downside to this injection was that some men reported side effects, including including depression, acne, and mood swings. Of course, women who are on hormonal birth control might also experience some of those same side effects, but the trial was actually stopped early because of the side effects. The mood swings, erectile dysfunction, or pain were things that were reported. And also, for one participant out of 320, one man had not returned to his normal sperm levels 4 years after an injection, so he remained at levels considered subfertile. My understanding is that gentleman was already had the kids that he wanted and was middle-aged, so he wasn't too upset about it, but obviously that is a side effect that we would want to avoid for anything that went on the market.
Now, this this gel that would be rubbed on shoulders and then the hormones get absorbed, where is that now in the process of creation and testing?
Yeah, good question. So right now, it has been created. It is in a laboratory, the project led by the U.S. National Institutes of Health and the Population Council, but they need to get the sign-off from all these nine locations in the U.S., U.K., Sweden, Italy, Chile, and Kenya before they can move forward with doling these out for the clinical trial. But NIH is hoping to sign up couples in early 2018.
Talking to Dina Fine-Marin right now from Scientific American, looking at her piece, The New Push for the Male Pill, looking at hormonal and other forms of birth control targeting men instead of women. And is there a sense of urgency that, yeah, we as a society, as a globe for that matter, need a birth control method that focuses on men?
I'd say definitely. The latest stats suggest that 40% of all pregnancies worldwide were unintended, so we're really looking for more options. Right now, options for male birth control are few. They're just condoms, vasectomy, and the ever-unreliable withdrawal, so we're always looking for more.
And when it comes to birth control and to a lot of medications for that matter, there's the effectiveness when it's used exactly as it's supposed to be, and then there's the effectiveness the way people actually use it in the real world. How big a stumbling block is that for trying to come up with a good male birth control?
Good question. Yeah, in the pilots testing with this same hormonal gel, about 89% of users had sperm counts reduced to 1 million per milliliter or less. That's considered successful sperm suppression. But while that number, 89%, may sound kind of low, we suspected in that trial that there was some level of noncompliance, meaning that men in the pilot trial were not using it for contraceptive purposes, so they didn't bother to take it regularly. By way of comparison, if you think of oral contraceptives for women, the failure rate is around 9%, and that's due to, according to the Centers for Disease Control, noncompliance and imperfect use.
We've been talking about hormonal male birth control. There are other ideas out there, I guess more mechanical in a way. What else is out there, at least on the drawing board?
Yeah, on the drawing board are several ways to, as you point out, sort of physically block this from happening. They seek to impede egg fertilization, but they've had yet to reach the same level of testing in men. One is in animal testing, a couple different compounds that would literally keep sperm from reaching maturity. So when one ejaculated, it wouldn't be a fully developed sperm. So essentially, it'd be shooting blanks, if you will. There is another non-hormonal product called Vasagel. It's a polymer hydrogel that would physically block sperm in the body so it couldn't reach an egg, and that's been tested in rabbits and in monkeys, but again, not in humans. And then there's another product that has been tested in Indonesia. Some of the science from that hasn't made it into peer-reviewed literature yet, but the idea is it would similarly prevent sperm from fertilizing an egg through some sort of blockage mechanism. So yeah, it's a field that's been having a lot that's been happening in the last couple decades, but so far not a lot of results.
Is there an idea that those non-hormonal methods, if they could be made to work, would be better? Because once you start tweaking around hormones, weird side effects are kind of hard to avoid completely.
Yeah, I think it would be preferable, one, because you'd avoid the side effects, but two, with a hormonal birth control method, it would take a while to kick in. So whereas maybe you could apply a gel ideally and you'd be ready to go, with something like this hormonal gel, scientists think it might take 2 to 3 months to suppress your sperm levels successfully. So if you were hoping to use it tonight, this is not the method for you.
Now, who's involved in the race to make a working male birth control method? Is this private industry, governments, NGOs? Who's really pushing hard for this?
Yeah, it's a bunch of different partners. Some of this research is being funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, like this gel that we're talking about today. But there's definitely a lot of interest from private companies, from pharmaceutical companies, because obviously they anticipate there being a market for this, both globally and in the United States. And I think that there are nonprofits that are really looking at this issue as well, in part to look at this question again. 40% of all pregnancies worldwide are unintended. This could be a way to help address that.
And some people might say, hey, we've got condoms already. Why do we need anything else for men?
Yeah, condoms aren't as well utilized as some people would hope for. A few years ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation put out a call asking for people to design, I guess, alternative condoms, ones that people might be more willing to put on. The idea maybe they'd be more sexy than we're thinking about today. Maybe they'd fit better. But I think that there's a popular conception that condoms just are not all that quote-unquote fun. And this, so we're constantly looking for ways to attack some of these problems in the bedroom while making sure that, you know, we're really having good effectiveness.
That said, condoms are part of unwanted pregnancy prevention and right. part of STD transmission prevention, whereas these
Absolutely.
Different methods of birth control we're talking about, they're just about pregnancy and fertility.
Exactly.
So how, I know it's hard to predict, research can hit, go in fits and starts, but any idea of how far we would be from a commercial product actually debuting on the market?
Yeah, as you would think, my crystal ball is a little fuzzy these days. But I think that something like this, the hormonal gel, could take maybe 5 years to get anywhere, because what you would have to do is you'll have to do this trial with more than 400 couples, and then they review the data. They think about side effects. Then they would submit to FDA for approval, and they'd need to get funding to scale it up. So really, to get to market, I think it would be probably 5 years or longer. But again, there are always factors that might change this. You know, maybe a different regulatory process could speed it along, or if results looked incredible, maybe it could be fast-tracked somehow and funding would become immediately apparent.
We'll leave it there for now. Dina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dina Fine-Marin is a health and medicine editor at Scientific American. She joined us to talk about the development of a new hormonal birth control method for men and, as we just heard, when something like that could hit the market. Now, the U.S. Senate passed a budget blueprint last night that is seen as a crucial step toward achieving the White House's goal of a tax code overhaul. Key elements include tax cuts, changes to so-called entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and an increase in defense spending.
The blueprint came in the form of a resolution, which affects the way it could pass through Congress and how quickly it could make it to the president's desk.
Today, House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin had this to say about the Senate's vote, talking on Good Morning America.
That gets us basically on track for being able to do what we call reconciliation, which is our ability to actually pass tax reform. So our plans are in place, the train's in the tracks, and we're rolling down the track. And the whole point of getting tax reform done, increase people's paychecks, higher wages, faster economic growth, which gets us a healthier economy and more jobs. And so that's what we're excited about, and we're really, really pleased the Senate did their heavy lifting.
Stephen Smith is a professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
So the Senate passed this budget blueprint. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the Congress has a budget process. It's been in place since 1974. It requires that if you're going to use a reconciliation bill, you have to authorize its use in advance with a budget resolution. So that's what they passed yesterday. The House has a different version, so the House will have to take up the Senate version. Word is that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the House Speaker Paul Ryan have come close to agreeing on a compromise so that they can act quickly on this budget resolution, which sets up a reconciliation bill, which is a bill that cannot be filibustered in the Senate and would be the vehicle for the tax cuts.
Is there a thought that there might be political opposition from Republicans in the House to some of what the Senate has passed now?
Yes, but Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell seem to have come up with language that will satisfy, I think, most Republicans. The biggest sticking point for House conservatives, the most conservative Republicans, was that they wanted assurance that there would be deep domestic spending cuts. In fact, the House version provided for $203 billion of cuts over 10 years, which is a pretty substantial whack at entitlement programs. The Senate version does not include that. The word seems to be that the House will back down on that. And how do you persuade the conservatives in the House to back down on that? Well, primarily by promising them a big tax cut bill. And that's what the Republicans are all about this week.
I know we don't actually have a tax cut bill in place. There have been some provisional ideas out there. But from what we see in this resolution from the Senate on the budget, what are we talking about in terms of the deficit? How would this affect our annual shortfalls?
We don't know, because we don't know the details of the tax bill. The budget resolution creates a lot of space for the tax bill. It allows the tax bill to reduce revenues and therefore increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion over 10 years. So that's a very, very large number. The Republicans argue, though, that once they get down to the details of their tax bill, the deficit effect will not be nearly that large. So we really don't know. The Republicans are counting on an argument that their tax bill will so stimulate the economy that the economy will grow so fast, and that will increase revenues because people will be earning more money. And actually, that will help soften the blow, reduce the effect of the tax cuts on the deficit, because actually more revenues will be coming in to offset the tax cuts. Democrats will say that's very naive thinking, but much of the debate is going to be over those kinds of macroeconomic matters, perhaps unfortunately, but that's the way the world is.
We've heard the argument before that tax cuts will lead to increased growth, that growth will lead to more taxes, which will balance out the loss of revenue. It's been tested some. I know there's lots of variables. Do we have an idea of the track record of whether it plays out that way?
Well, honestly, most economists would argue that it simply is true that a tax cut, depending upon the type, can stimulate the economy. Increase incomes for some people, which means they have higher taxable incomes and increase the revenue from those people, but it doesn't really pay for itself. In fact, it doesn't really come close to paying for itself. And so we can expect deficits to rise if the Republican plans proceed as now they look from at least today. My guess is that we're going to see hundreds of billions of dollars of additional deficit over a 10-year period if the Republicans proceed with the tax cuts that they're talking about today.
We're talking to Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at a Senate budget blueprint passed yesterday and the prospects for a big tax overhaul that Republicans are hoping to do fairly soon. Another big question, Steve, about tax cuts is who gets the tax cuts? There's been talk about targeting the middle class, accusations that they'll be for corporations and people at the top of the income scale. Again, there's not an official bill in place, but what do we know about what Republicans have been talking about for their tax cut plans?
Well, there was a preliminary plan presented that was the product of negotiations between the White House and top party and tax leaders among Republicans on Capitol Hill. And it includes a sizable corporation income tax cuts. If you're a very large corporation now and you have an income over $18 million, you're going to pay a 35% rate. The Republicans are talking about cutting that down to 20% or lower. So that's a huge reduction in the corporate tax cut. Initially, the Republican view was that this could be paid for by reducing loopholes. So corporations that have special tax breaks would lose those special tax breaks in exchange for getting a lower rate. Now there's so much opposition to some of the there's so much support for retaining some of those tax breaks that it doesn't look like they'll come anywhere close to paying for the rate cut with the elimination of tax breaks. It's eliminating tax breaks that usually is what we call tax reform. And reform seems to be slipping as a priority here in favor of cuts.
And that corporate tax rate, as you point out, 35%, a lot of people argue that big corporations tend not to effectively pay 35%, in part because of those loopholes, if people don't like them, or incentives or whatever, lower the effective tax rate for corporations. Is that by and large true?
That's absolutely right. And what you're missing there is that a lot of corporate income is parked abroad and not taxed in the U.S. at all. This is a very complicated thing, and there was some hope. In fact, I think bipartisan agreement that much of the tax code needs to be restructured in a more fundamental way. But it looks like opposition to one kind of restructuring or another among Republicans is probably going to lead to setting aside some interest in dealing with the breaks and dealing with foreign income, and instead focusing on simply reducing the rates.
And there has been talk about simplifying the tax paying and tax filing process for individuals and families filing their taxes. The idea of going back to, you could fill out a postcard-sized tax form instead of going to the full easy form or more complicated things. And it seems like a lot of people on both sides of the aisle like the idea of simplifying. Is that part of what we're seeing from the Republican plan so far?
Well, they're not talking about that, at least not this week. They certainly have in the past. But to do that for your average middle-class taxpayer who's maybe has a mortgage, lives in a state with a personal income tax, and has other complications, it's hard to do that to deal with those issues in a postcard size form. There is some Republican interest in eliminating the deduction for state and local taxes that you now enjoy, and so states with relatively important or high personal income taxes would lose that, and that would increase their federal taxes accordingly. But there's a lot of opposition to that. There are many, many Republicans in Congress who represent suburban districts in high tax states like New York, California, Minnesota, that will object to touching that particular tax break. Well, if you start protecting tax breaks, well, then the form has to be somewhat longer, and it will not fit on a postcard. So there may be more people who can file a very short form, and perhaps this can be done on a postcard in the future, but I think we're some distance from knowing whether they're going to change the code so radically that'll be an important development for many people.
We're talking with Steve Smith right now, looking at the budget blueprint that the U.S. Senate passed last night and how it leads along the path toward a GOP tax overhaul plan. He's professor of political science at Washington University.
And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Do you support Republican tax cut efforts? What about the changes potentially coming to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? Do you hope this measure speeds up the process for passage in Congress? Let us know what you think by calling 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing our conversation about the Senate's passage of a budget blueprint yesterday that is seen as key to the president's tax overhaul goals. Stephen Smith stays with us. He's a professor of political science at Washington University.
What do you think? You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you support an overhaul of the U.S. tax code? Does this sound like how you'd like to do it from what you've seen from the Republican plan so far? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. CJ is with us in Madison. CJ, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Ultimately, your question is, do we agree? If their plan approved in the long haul is going to reverse this trend of a huge deficit that this country sees, and that reversal is going to benefit the economy and make the economy stronger. Because there's a lot of talk out there that a huge deficit, like in the trillions and trillions and trillions, could be very, very poor for our economy in the long haul. So you got to start righting that ship at some point. Now, with that said, if what they're trying to do isn't going to do that, then, I mean, it's just another Washington idea that's just a bunch of crap.
CJ, thanks for calling in. CJ, hopeful that whatever plan comes out would reduce the deficit. And he brought up the argument that a big deficit and a big national debt, ultimately, Steve, is bad for the economy. Do we know if that's true?
In the long run, it certainly is. Just like a homeowner, you borrow money to improve your house, you might actually increase its long-term value. And when we make investments as a society in education and our roads and other things, we hope that that will have long-term payoffs, and they often do. The question here is whether or not the deficits that will be created, and they definitely will be created unless the Republicans surprise us, these long-term deficits created by tax cuts, these tax cuts will generate enough economic activity to pay for themselves. And honestly, there may be a handful of economists out there who would make that argument, but it's very few. The trouble for the Republicans is that to pay for these tax cuts, especially the size of the tax cuts they're talking about, they would have to make very deep cuts in domestic programs. And in fact, the Senate budget waves its hand at the possibility of $500 billion of cuts in Medicaid, $1 trillion of cuts in Medicare over the next 10 years. I say waves its hand at it because the Senate bill doesn't require those spending savings be passed along with the tax cuts. So they've allowed the tax cuts to go ahead on their own without any compensating changes in spending. So it will increase the deficit. It's a big question about how much that deficit increase will be, and there'll be a lot of argument about it.
And you mentioned earlier House Republicans, their plan had involved a bigger commitment to cutting those entitlement, in quotes, programs, Medicare, Medicaid, things like
that. Well, that's right. There was at least a sizable effort to pay for the tax cuts by reducing spending. Social welfare-related programs, for example, were to be cut by $203 billion. The House had some fakery, if I can use the term, in that it assumed that Obamacare would be fully repealed and that all the spending on Obamacare would be saved. And, of course, that hasn't happened. So we're dealing with a House version that lacks realism. and the Senate seems to be the way the Republicans now intend to go. That is, put tax cuts in place without compensation on the spending side.
CJ, thanks for that call. We're talking about the budget, the federal budget, and a tax overhaul effort from Republicans. Steve Smith is with us from Washington University. Back to your calls now. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'm definitely a part of the middle class, and I have children. I drive on Wisconsin roads every day. I service the people of inner city Milwaukee through my job in healthcare, and I'm terrified about the proposed tax plan and what that means for the future of this state, the future of this country, the future of my children. I've lived abroad and I've seen in Europe how taxes can really go to supporting a lot of the services that we all benefit from, and I just can't for the life of me fathom why we continue to promote decreasing taxes as an improvement for our country. It just feels like a plan and a scheme for a certain portion of our population, a very small portion of our population that has very little touch with what's going on in the rest of this country. worry.
Kelly, thanks for the call. Steve Kelly worried that tax cuts will lead to cuts in services that help people at the bottom end of the income scale.
Well, I think that's a very legitimate concern. You know, there are Republicans, so I don't think it's all Republicans, who would argue that cutting taxes and greatly increasing the deficit is a perfect way to starve the beast being big government. And so even if there is some economic pain by increasing the size of the deficit, maybe seeing a spike in interest rates, it will be worth it if over the long run, maybe years and years, the federal government's size is simply must be reduced in order to avoid the harm of increasing the federal debt so much. And that may be where the Republicans end up with their arguments over the next few weeks. We heard that in the early Reagan years. Not all Republicans buy into that. It's kind of a supply-side type argument. And there are certainly Republicans in Congress now who are very concerned about the deficit implications. Senator Corker from Tennessee, for example, has indicated that he will not support a tax cut that increases the deficit. We'll see if he holds to that. So there is some sensitivity to this. But we're talking about basic philosophy about the role of government, and there are many Republicans who say starving the beast is a reasonable approach to getting to smaller government.
Thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Catherine in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
What do you think, Catherine?
Yes, and I've been listening on the radio to your speaker, and I don't really understand how hurting so many of the lower class, the middle class. I'm 71. I worked all my life. I have two children, one who's 46 and one who's 25. My 46-year-old was very thankful for President Obama because she had been able to have insurance through his administration where she never had it before. And I'm on Social Security and Medicare, and I don't see how we're going to be protected by that Republican.
Catherine, I want to jump in because we're a little short on time. Steve, are Republicans going to feel pressure from people like Catherine and her daughter, people who rely on Social Security, Medicare, and Obamacare, for that matter?
Yes. You know, the amazing thing is that the Republican plan coming out of the Senate really doesn't make any significant changes in federal spending programs this year or next year, for that matter. They sort of hope to get through the 2018 elections without being responsible for significant changes in federal programs. But they want to get the tax cuts in place that will lead to spending cuts in the future, but not in the very short term.
We'll leave it there for now. Catherine, thanks for your call. And Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
That's Stephen Smith. He's a professor of political science at Washington University. He joined us to talk about yesterday's Senate passage of a budget blueprint and the prospects for a big change in the U.S. tax system. You can still share your thoughts on all this. By the way, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.